All right. The meeting of the Health and Human Services Policy Committee will come to order. Representative Finstead, will you move the minutes of the March 12th meeting? Thank you. Any discussion of that? All right, all in favor of adopting those minutes, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? And the motion prevails. We're gonna skip around a little bit on the agenda today for convenience of different people who have come a long way. We're gonna start with House Bill 3881, Representative Emmer. Representative Emmer, you'll move 3881, I take it.
Yes, sir.
And then it'd be recommended to pass and go to the Finance Committee.
Okay. So moved. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I want to thank the chairman for making accommodation, especially at this late stage with all the things that are going on. I'm going to introduce you to the Losey family in just a second. The bill before you, 3881, is a very simple bill with very large ramifications. Briefly, what this would allow is exactly what it says. In a case where someone has to reconstruct or reconfigure or remodel their home to make it handicap accessible, in the event that creates extra square footage, the Loseys will tell you that they run into a problem where they cannot get the programs to pay for those improvements. Steve Losey, I don't want to take away everything he's going to tell you. I'll let him tell his story, but I think he's going to tell you there is a significant cost savings. For instance, a one-time payment of up to $80,000 to construct the handicap accessible improvements versus an annual $120,000 or more to house their son away from the home. So with that, I turn it over to Steve Losey to tell you their story.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Losey.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Steve Losey. This is my wife, Beth, and my son, Kyle. About 5 years ago, our son, Kyle, fell in our home and hit his head, bumped it on carpeted steps, and from that very instant on, we lost our son and have a very different young man. For the last 3 years, we've been trying to work with Wright County Human Services on the modification of our home so Kyle can stay in our home and we can care for him there. Unfortunately, after 3 years of work, we've been pretty much torpedoed. I think that they technically want to help us, but simply can't find a way to help us in approving the modifications because of the statutes and regulations as currently written that state they cannot pay for added square footage. But the perfect storm is brewed for us in our home. We have a modest single-family home. It's a split level, and we have a wheelchair to deal with. We have narrow, normal hallways and a very small bathroom facility on the main floor. Our home, as built, simply cannot be modified to accommodate our son, Kyle, without the additional square footage. We need to add on a room that would be Kyle's bathroom. And our appeal was denied by the State of Minnesota Human Resources, or Human Services Commissioner, I believe is his title. So we lost our appeal, and now we've come to Representative Emmer to seek his help and your help in changing that statute so that it will allow for payment of an additional room for Kyle's bathroom. When it boils down to it, as a small businessman myself, I can tell you that sometimes it should just boil down to the money. Right now, in foster care placement, the government, us, the taxpayers, are spending in excess of $125,000 a year to keep him out of our own house, when they could incur a one-time expenditure of about $80,000 to perhaps $100,000 now with cost increases, a one-time expense that would allow us to bring him home and be with his family.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Representative Abler.
Well, Mr. Emmer, thanks for bringing this forward. Mr. Chair, can someone from the department tell me why on earth we wouldn't? Our theme of all the time has been to keep people in their homes, to put them in the lowest cost, best environment, and this doesn't meet any of those tests. Is the department going to testify about why this couldn't be done and what the sort of calling for a waiver that they couldn't just do this out of some... Because we have different funds. We have you know, all those little different waiver programs and those side pots of money. So why do they even have to come? Like, we should certainly do this for all, by all means, but I'm surprised that we put people through this.
I don't know. I see that they need federal approval, and I don't know if it has something to do with the federal laws. The department can come down, but if...
Maybe Rep. Emmer knows offhand why they couldn't do that.
Welcome to committee.
Hi, I'm Heidi Hamilton with the Department of Human Services. Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, our current waiver plans do not allow us to complete modifications that add additional square footage to a home. So if this language is passed, we would need to submit a waiver amendment to the federal government for approval.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler. Okay, I'll accept that answer, but I find myself puzzled that a department with as good a... Maybe you can stay, ma'am. I won't be too rough on you. You're the messenger, I know, so I... But I'm just astonished that a system that can't do this all by itself and find $80,000 through another waiver or pot of money or through some way that make these people have to come do this. And the reason I'm asking the question is not for this very nice family here, but in people who talk to the department about other things, there's layers and layers upon bureaucracy stuff that no one can figure out. And common sense just ceases to prevail. Does this happen a lot? That's my question to you, ma'am. Does this happen a lot when people try to find a way through the system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ayler, I'm not aware of any other requests to add additional square footage for this type of remodel. I haven't heard of, personally, of any other requests.
I won't. Mr. Chair, we're short of money. No? $935 million. We got a Department of Human Services that's growing at 14% or so of biennium. And we're hoping that they do stuff in an efficient way. And every time I hear these stories, I just get sad. On behalf of the people that we wish we could serve, we have to cap waivers to try to get people in the programs. Anyway, good luck. And if you can just tell them downtown when you go back there that it's a legislative intent that they bend every rule they can to serve the people the best they can with the money they got to make it go as far as possible. If you need bending permission, come to us and we'll give you permission to bend the state rules anyway so we can take care of our citizens. And you're just a messenger, so thank you for coming and being so brave.
Thank you. Representative Lieberman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I mean, I think we can all appreciate the difficulty here and, you know, in your desire to do this, but I do have a question about, you know, if this law were to pass and if you were able to add this square footage at state expense, would there be any guarantee that you'd be caring for your son at home instead of continuing in the place that he is? I mean, you know, maybe you do that for a year and then maybe some other circumstance would occur and it would, you know, become too difficult for you to manage at home. I mean, there's really nothing that would prevent that from happening, right?
Mr. Hello. Chairman and committee members, I believe that there is no way that we as a family can guarantee what would happen in the years to come. Kyle's medical, physical situation could change at any moment. He was suffering from seizures for the first 4 years, 2 to 3 on a daily basis, and with one new medication a year ago this month, he has not had one seizure. But I would tell you this. The cost savings of adding this addition could be recovered in the time frame of 1 year of paying for the foster care situation. So if we made it over a year, the government taxpayers are ahead of the game.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And another question that I have, though, too, is presumably this modification would add to the value of your home. And so if you were to, and maybe you could address that, but if you were to turn around and sell your home in a year, say this worked out for you well for a year, and then you decided that, you know, you needed to move somewhere else, I mean, there would be no kind of recapture here for the state's investment, would there?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, in my response to your question regarding the increased value of our home, I personally dispute that. I would tell you that if we execute these modifications to our small single-family home in Delano, that in fact may not be worth more, but could in fact be worth less, as we remove possibly 90 to 95% of the people who could possibly buy our home would no longer want it. It's going to dramatically change our home by installing a wheelchair lift in the main entryway, adding on a large-style bathroom for handicap accessibility. I'm sorry, but I dispute the fact that it increases the value of our home.
Representative Weebly.
Just to follow up on that, your point is, well taken. We don't know that. But, if we were to enact this change to statute, it may be in some cases it wouldn't, and in some cases it would. And I guess I do have a concern. In a world where we had unlimited funds, I mean, it sounds like it'd be a great thing to do. But, I do have kind of a concern about, adding funds for something takes funds away from something else, I guess. And there is that issue about, even in your case, if it doesn't add to the cost, add to the value of your home, sometimes it might. And I just think that there's a lot of questions here for me that aren't really answered to the point, I think, where I'm ready to say, let's go ahead and do this.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, great question. I would ask you, take a close look at the actual language, because I think that's one of the reasons that it's so narrowly drafted for a bathroom and wheelchair access. And just keep in mind that we're talking about cost savings that are dramatic. You'll recover them all within a year, and then in fact, on that balance sheet, the state, it's the wrong way to put it, but actually makes money after that because it's not spending that $125 a year.
Okay. Representative Broad?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just was going to, from an appraisal standpoint, when you have a home that has such unique features like the one that the testifier is suggesting, oftentimes it does diminish the number of people who are willing to purchase those homes, goes exactly what the testifier was saying in terms of the direction of the value. So when you have they call it functional obsolescence, if you want a technical term, but there's all sorts of things that happen in homes that are good for the people who live there, but they're not good in terms of marketability of the properties. And so, we have to be careful when we discuss the valuations of these things, because oftentimes it's contrary to logic, and I think this might be similar in terms of the approach.
Any further discussion, members? Representative Emmer, any?
No, thank you very much.
Okay. Representative Emmer will renew his motion that House File 3881 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you for coming down.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
There you go. Representative Saylor, I think we'll do your bill. Yes. So, Representative Seda, I will move that House File 3559 be recommended pass and re-refer to the General Register. Welcome to the committee. And I see, is this a delete element? Or delete element? Or do you want to move that? Okay, I will move the A081362 amendment to get the bill in the form the author would like it. All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? That motion prevails. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. I will not say a whole lot about it. I will leave it for my testifiers, but I will say that Mr. Ed Ramson, who is the director of the DAC, Developmental Achievement Center, who also works, the broader title being the Day Training and Habilitation Center in Park Rapids, brought this situation to my attention some time ago with regard to a way to increase some flexibility for the day training habilitation organizations and also increase some efficiency in how the state works with the licensure. This bill has already gone before the Senate and moved along satisfactorily there. The department is okay with this bill, and so I will just turn this over to my testifiers to speak to the need for this bill to work on the licensure for their facilities. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I'll try to be brief. There are about 14,000 adults with developmental disabilities receiving training from day training and rehabilitation services here in the state. There are about 275 programs. I am a member of the Minnesota Developmental Achievement Center Association, which is one of the trade organizations, and I am speaking on their behalf as well as my own today. The issue is the question of multiple licenses for programs who serve our clients. As it stands, if a program has separate facilities, that is, separate buildings, they must acquire a separate, complete separate license for each facility. So if you have two buildings that stand side by side, you actually have to apply for and receive a DP&H license from the Department of Human Services. It's sort of an anachronism. It causes duplicative paperwork, and in many cases just doesn't make sense. In our case, for instance, we have a program in downtown Park Rapids. As we've grown, we've needed more space, so we've purchased or bought additional buildings. We now run a thrift store two blocks from our main center. We have to license that as if it were a separate facility, meaning going through all the paperwork. Every year we have to send in a new license application, multiple copies of everything, yet our clients and our staff simply rotate between the buildings. There are a number of programs that actually have buildings on the same property, and they are also licensed as separate facilities. If there were to build breezeways between them, they could have a single license. So what we're trying to do is simply reduce this multiple license requirement to one license per program that is within a reasonable geographic area, and it's a count by the county, as we state in the request we're making. This affects probably 25 to 30 programs, possibly 40 programs. I think the department has said about 30 programs. It will allow us to do one set of paperwork, have one licensing visit, and in fact the department treats as if it were all one license anyway. We usually have one licensing visit. We bill from one single center. We don't use our multiple licenses for billing. So this just recognizes the state of the art as it is. There is virtually no fiscal impact, slight to minimal cost. The department can address that, but I don't think they find any problem there. So we're asking a little bit more flexibility, a little bit less bureaucracy. This is a change just to make things go quicker and easier for us.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Did you want to speak, sir? Okay. And does anybody have any questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Saylor, or your testifier, I didn't catch it, maybe I wasn't listening close enough, but how much is going to be saved by doing this as far as reducing the amount of licensees and all the things?
In our case, and the department should probably address the overall case better, but in our case, it will probably reduce our licensing fee by $200. However, currently we license our center facility so that all of our clients can come to it. Then we license a separate facility because we have a dozen clients that go there. Okay, so we're paying essentially double licensing fees. What the department has added an amendment to this so that the fee schedule really isn't changed, and that we will simply charge per client, or we will be charged per client in this bill. So it really doesn't change things very much. I think that the change is actually a couple hundred dollars per facility affected, and again, I think there are about 25 or 30 facilities that might make a change. So it's minimal. The savings is instead of sending in multiple copies of paperwork to the department, having them go through it, instead of us having to produce multiple copies, you know, so already my trip down here is going to cost me what I'll save in the first year. But it just removes a thorn in our side, and I think it even gives the department a little more flexibility.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion, members? Okay, seeing none. I'll renew my motion that House Bill 3559 be recommended to pass as amended to the General Register. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Thank you for bringing this to us. This
Thank
is kind
you
of
very
thing
much.
That really helps. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Bunn. Welcome to the welcome to the committee. There we go.
I feel welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And committee members. This in your packets says Huntley on it, if you're confused. Okay. Originally Representative Huntley was chairing us. We switched. There had been a mix up at the beginning. So it's House File 3710 and it says Huntley and others on your House research sheet. Mr. Chair, this is a bill about permitting
we'll just have you move this just be recommended to pass the General Register.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, this is a bill about, thank you for hearing me. This bill amends existing law to prevent hospital records to be transferred to electronic image or other state-of-the-art electronic preservation technology. The existing law in this area of archiving and preserving our records was drafted in 1941 and references photographic film to describe the reproduction method in use. The bill also modifies the divestiture time frame for which paper copies of the medical records must be maintained after they have been transferred to photographic film, electronic image, or other state-of-the-art electronic preservation technology. With me today is Diane Larson from St. Luke's Hospital in Duluth. In addition to representing St. Luke's, Diane speaks on behalf of the Minnesota Health Information Management Association. Diane is going to provide additional information supporting this legislation.
Welcome to the committee.
Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Diane Larson. I'm the Director of Medical Records at St. Luke's Hospital in Duluth. I am currently the President-elect of the Minnesota Health Information Management Association. This association is interested in ensuring the accurate, complete, and timely documentation of care provided to all Minnesota patients, as well as the preservation of that information. We are the guardians of your medical records. The Minnesota Health Information Management Association supports House File 3710 introduced by Representative Bunn. It addresses a concern common to all Minnesota hospitals. The bill amends Minnesota Statute 2006 Section 145.31 and 145.32 by including electronic image or other state-of-the-art electronic preservation technology as an acceptable means to store medical record information. The legislation also allows for the elimination of expenses mandated by existing statute requiring that health records that have been transferred to electronic format must also be retained in paper form for a period of 3 years. Expenses required to comply with Minnesota Statute 145.32 are considerable. For example, FMDC projects expenses associated with retained paper health records that have already been transferred to electronic form to exceed $490,000 per year. St. Luke's Hospital will expend in excess of $112,000 per year. These expenses are reflective of costs incurred by all Minnesota hospitals, and there is no added value for direct patient care because we access that information electronically and not by retrieving the paper documents. The following Minnesota hospitals have expressed support for this legislation: Alina, CentraCare, Fairview, Healthies, Lakeview and Stillwater, Lakeview and Two Harbors, Virginia Regional Medical Center, SMDC, St. Luke's, North Memorial Healthcare, and Grand Itasca in Grand Rapids. I am not familiar with any hospital objecting to this amendment, and thank you very much for this opportunity to present this legislation. and I am happy to answer any questions you might have.
Are there any questions, members? Okay, I'm going to move the A08-1388 amendment, which really has not much to do with this bill, but is another Department of Health issue. And this is amendment would do would be would allow someone to designate the type of vehicle that they would that they could be transported into their burial, I guess. That's what it does. So they could direct that happens, and then it would just in statute allow that conveyance be used to transport the body.
Madam Director, Mr. Chair, is that in our version of the bill?
It is in your packet. It should be following right after 3710. It's the A08-1388.
Oh.
You can have my copy if you want.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Just want to add in support of the argument here that on line 2.11 of the amendment in question, it does indicate it should be a dignified conveyance.
Yes. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I don't have a problem with the amendment as such, but I think I'd like to make an oral amendment to the amendment. Can I do that?
Sure.
Okay. I would like to strike. I'd like to strike line 2.10, and actually, I think to make that actually work, I probably need to on line 2.9. I probably need to change the semicolon to a period. And then strike the end as well. And members, the reason I'm doing that is because if you remember, I carried the bill last year that actually added this line. And I've had some opportunities to think about that, and I actually think that was not a wise thing to do. And the reason is because, there are, I think that there is something about people's freedom of choice in these matters that really ought to be preserved. And while some people might think that putting the driver and the body in the same cab is a really important and appropriate thing to do, I don't think that everybody would feel that way. And so I would like to move to strike that provision as well.
Okay, so I think the amendment is on line 2.5, you had an and.
On line 2.9.
And well, we should add an and on 2.5, I think. And then on 2.9, strike the semicolon in the word and insert a period. Strike line 2.10. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Okay, I'll just incorporate that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Baylor.
And
I would say, just before, the Department of Health, prior to that amendment, and I don't know if they have an issue, is very comfortable with this language.
All right, so it's just an interesting bill to put that amendment on. I've done the same thing myself more than once in the past.
We're doing our best here.
I realize I'm trying to...
Not my
turn.
Okay.
Yeah, I respect that. The bill, the amendment really is just what's on page one then, pretty much. Is that right?
It's page one and page two.
Oh, you stuck that one. Okay.
Now,
there was some talk about an amendment like this about who can transport a deceased body... if they had to be licensed funeral director, is this that amendment?
No.
This is a different amendment.
This is to allow, I think it arose from a circumstance where a firefighter had died and they wanted to transport the firefighter on a fire truck and weren't able to do that. It's about the vehicle.
Very few cases.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, man. I think it's a wonderful amendment, and I appreciate your
There you go.
Flexibility on this bill.
I just have a one-word amendment prior to my original bill, but you should do that first.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Any further discussion on the 1388 amendment?
Mm-hmm.
Seeing none, all in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
With this kind of amendment going on here, is this the kind of flexibility we'll see on the floor when we bring amendments forward on other bills like this?
Mm-hmm. We have clear germaneness rules on the
floor. Oh, on the floor. See. Thank you.
Representative Bunn.
Mr. Chair, the following one-word amendment on the original bill on line 1.17, after the number 145.31, strike the word sodostatic. This was already done in the Senate version. You'll see in the lines below that the word photostatic has been stricken in the text, so just to be consistent.
Okay. All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? That motion prevails. Any further discussion on the bill? Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, this is a bill that looks like it will save about $600,000 to Duluth hospitals, and if you multiply that by the rest of the hospitals around the state, it's going to save millions. And for those that are concerned about paper backup, I would like to tell them about the mesothelioma study on the range where they stored the records in a basement of a building on the university, and the building flooded and they lost all those records.
Mm-hmm.
So this is actually a safer way to keep that data.
All right, seeing no further discussion, Representative Bunn renews her motion that House File 3710 be passed as amended to the General Register. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Representative Murphy. Representative Murphy will move that House File 3708 be passed to the General Register. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have the pleasure of carrying the Department of Health Occupation Licensing Board dealing with audiologists. And Mr. Hindlemeyer is here with me to explain the bill. I do have an amendment with the bill in the order that we would like it. It is the AO8 amendment.
Excuse me, the which one?
The AO8 amendment. But I would move the AO8 amendment. Put the bill in the order.
Okay, and I'm just looking for it here. Is that the one that has the Board of Audiology?
Correct.
Okay. So Representative Murphy will move the AO8-1315 amendment. All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? That motion prevails. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to introduce Mr. Tom Hindlemeyer, who is going to walk us through the bill.
Welcome, Chair. My name is Tom Hindlemeyer. I am Director of the Health Occupations Program in the Minnesota Department of Health. We regulate the occupations that are the subject of this bill, including audiologists, speech language pathologists, hearing instrument dispensers, and occupational therapy practitioners. And I can briefly summarize the bill referencing the sections, or I can go section by section if they have a preference.
Yes, that was. If people have, maybe we should see if people have questions, or do you want to, why don't we run through it quickly, section by section?
Mr. Chair, the bill is non-controversial, and our amendment strikes the first section, which became controversial after we introduced it. Section 2 on page 2. Limits the supervisor of a license to all those who meet requirements for licensing and excludes temporary licensees. Section 3 changes language so that we can accept a letter in lieu of a transcript from the academic program. Section 4 corrects an internal cross-reference. On page 4, section 5, we are making the same change, making it an option available to audiologists as well as speech language pathologists. In section 6, on page 5, we are providing additional time to audiologists in which to and an additional opportunity to get a temporary license. And in section 7, we are making the requirements clear for the licensees in terms of what we expect of them in terms of corresponding with the department about changes in their status. In section 8, we are deleting expired language and clarifying for licensees what their, particularly the audiologists, what their fee covers in terms of department activities. In section 9, we are making a change to the language regarding penalty fees, and this change appears three places in the bill. essentially we are defining the term missing for continuing education credits on continuing education reports. Moving to page 6, 7, and 8, section 10, we are changing the word aid to instruments, and we're requiring that dispensers of hearing instruments that includes audiologists and certified dispensers, that they put their personal identification number on audiograms which are given to consumers. In section 11, on page 9, we are clarifying the continuing education requirements for individuals who renew after licenses expire. In section 11, on page 11, I'm sorry, section 12 on page 11, we're clarifying the requirement for licensees, again, name change or address change. In section 13, which is quite a lengthy section, we are essentially clarifying that for occupational therapists, they need to take a course in physical agent modalities before they start using them in their practice. On page 15, section 14, we are clarifying the continuing education requirements for occupational therapists, and that the hours to be earned are to be done so between the effective dates of the license. Section 15, on page 16, we're increasing the number of hours a licensee may accumulate continuing education coursework related to business topics when it's directly related to their practice area. In section 16, this is the same change as in section 9, regarding the definition of missing for continuing education credits. In section 17 on page 18, this section is deleted by the amendment that was just added. In section 18 on page 19, we are clarifying that, again, that the continuing education is to be earned between the effective dates of the certification. In section 19, we're specifying that the title to be used by trainees when dealing with consumers. And in section 21, we are, in section 20, we are again amending the information concerning current information of practitioners with the department. And in section 21, again defining what missing means regarding continuing education credits on their report. And those are the changes. Is there any questions?
And then Representative Lieberman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on this, for example, on section line 11.5, where you have a change in name must be accompanied by a copy of a marriage certificate or court order, I guess I'm not sure what the state of the general law is right now, but I had sort of understood that a person could use any name that they wanted to as long as it wasn't for fraudulent purposes. I'm not sure if that's the law, but that's kind of what I had understood. And I'm just wondering if in other areas, you know, whether this is a practice as well, that you have to come in with a copy. Or, you know, is this just kind of updating current practice that is current practice in other areas of licensure, or, you know, I'm just trying to get my arms around what the problem is here that we're solving. Is it just a technical issue?
Mr. Chair, Representative
Liebling.
Liebling, I'm sorry. This is our common practice, and we're basically writing it into the statute so that licensees have notice of what it is they would need to do to make a name change, and we do this across all of us, our regulatory system.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. And one other kind of similar question on line 2.31, where you and going on there, in addition to the transcript, the commissioner may require a letter from the academic department chair or program director documenting the completed coursework. Can you just kind of tell us what's prompting that change?
Mr. Chair and Representative, these these licensees have recently changed their requirements for licensing from a master's degree to a doctoral level. And some programs issue evidence or put on the transcript that they have completed master's level work, and others do not. Where we do not get evidence that master's level work has been completed, this explicitly says that we can accept a letter from the department chair that the individual has completed master's level and or is enrolled in doctorate level work, entitling them to practice in a clinical setting with a temporary credential.
Thank you. Any other questions for this witness member? Mm-hmm. All right, to the amendments.
We have a few. Madam Chair.
That's the question. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to the amendments, Representative Bunn. What are you?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have the House File 3708A1 amendment. That's the word exemption in bold in the middle. Madam Chair and members, this is an amendment addressing a licensing exemption. This was a Swales bill that came to our committee. Unfortunately, the licensing committee discontinued its meeting over a week ago Monday, unbeknownst even at that time to the licensing committee until we heard it in committee. So this bill came forward the next day, and on the advice of Chair Cheeson and Chair Chow, I was asked to bring it on behalf of Representative Swales to this committee as an amendment to this bill. Essentially, what this is a case of a unique individual with a particular background that led to an issue with regards to becoming licensed in the state of Minnesota. Before you should be a handout coming around. Do you have it? Okay. A handout that says Ben licensing at top. This individual is licensed, is originally from Germany, is licensed as a physical therapist in Germany, can be practiced in 27 European countries, European Union countries. He's also licensed to practice in Illinois, Ohio, and Wisconsin, and currently travels to Wisconsin from her home in Woodbury, where she is a wife, a mother of four, and a respected member of our community. I also represent part of Woodbury. And she applied for licensing in Minnesota and was denied licensing in Minnesota by the Board of Physical Therapy because, as you'll see towards the bottom sheet, because she had a 0.8% was below the score needed to pass the exam at that time from 1984. In this situation, she appealed this ruling initially, and she was recommended for licensure by a Minnesota Administrative Hearing Officer in 2006. She was recommended for licensure by the Minnesota Board of Physical Therapy Licensing Committee in June of 2006. She was recommended for licensure by the Assistant Attorney General in June of 2006. She was then denied licensure by the Minnesota Board of Physical Therapy. Their concern being, I think I won't speak for them, but I think the general idea is that they want to maintain a very firm standard for licensure in the state. They have one of the strictest licensing procedures in the country. They also, as we know from being on this committee, have been seeking to change direct access and other things related to their profession, and many of us have supported that. And so in this situation, this individual has been struggling for 4 years that I know of to try to obtain license in Minnesota. Some of her clients traveled to Wisconsin in order to receive her services. And it, as I said, it was the ruling of several of these groups to say that the issue, if you look at her entire record, her qualifications, her portfolio, a clean record of service, recommendations, etc., that it would seem an appropriate case for exemption, particularly with the path she has followed. As I think myself and other members of our licensing committee would attest, I think the issue of reciprocity is one that we need to take up with our, in general, with our healthcare professions and evaluate whether they are consistent with one another, consistent with other professional areas like law and other areas. But this particular case we'd like to deal with at this time because it's been in process for a very long time. The language in this amendment was done in collaboration with the Board of Physical Therapy. They are neutral on this amendment. and were involved in shaping this particular language. I'd be glad to stand for questions or comments.
President Norton.
I have a question, and I think after the question I'll make my comment. Can this individual retake the exam?
Mm-hmm. Representative Bunn.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that one could always retake an exam, but two issues regarding that. One is, first of all, it would be a different exam today. They have a different type, a different exam than they had in 1984. And secondly, as if any of us was asked to go back and take, for example, the bar exam that we studied for 20 years ago, it would be, or 22 years ago in this case, it might be a very challenging thing to do. So I guess the argument here is that for someone who's practiced for over 20 years and has licensing in a variety of states and countries already, that the portfolio of their record combined with that experience should be sufficient not to have to go back and redo what one did so many years ago in terms of the academic portion of this.
And Mr. Chair, I knew the answer to that, but I wanted her to speak it publicly, and I'm going to support this amendment, and I'm going to give just a brief tell you why. My husband decided many years ago to go into private practice after serving for the federal government for 13 years as a PhD licensed psychologist, and he was licensed in the state of Nebraska and the state of Colorado, quit his job, went out to private practice, and there was no reciprocity. So he was forced to take the exam several times. He, too, had been in college in the 80s, and it was 20 years, and he'd been practicing successfully for many since then, all of them, I should say, since then. And it was a huge hardship for our family, and very, very expensive to retake these exams over and over. So I'm very sympathetic to this individual, and I'm going to support this amendment here, but I really would call on this committee, the licensing committee, in future years to look at all licensing areas. Sometimes there are reasons we need to not accept reciprocity. If there are states that have very low expectations, but there are other states who are higher than ours, and there are other states who are, similar, and I think we could be a little more uniform across many licensing boards on this issue. So I speak in favor of this, and I feel very sorry for the woman, and personally know what she's going through.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bunn did talk to me on it. In the committee, we have give exceptions to many individuals, and we have had bills to help individuals in similar situations, so I don't see this as any different. So,
thank you, President
Abel. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, we do this sort of thing from time to time, and they're pretty far between. And so I don't mind the amendment. I just did want to comment on the raft of amendments I see coming, all of which look like they were bills and could well have been processed properly through Representative Tao's committee. And I'm disappointed that these couldn't get their proper vetting there. I don't know when they're introduced. And the reason, having done a lot of work in licensure, these are very nuanced kinds of things, and now we're in the last day of deadlines, and I appreciate that. But the reason that you have a committee like that, here you have a whole department bill, which is thick and full of little technical things, and it's fine, but we don't know what we're doing with it. And in terms of the process, and the reason they have licensure is that it's very specific, detailed, and there's a reason they have every one of these. There is a reason the board couldn't waive this or didn't. But I hope that I would have brought some amendments of my own if I know we're just going to load them up here. I hope we try to have good process, and the committees are really important, and these are maybe minor, but some of the bills we took in our committee work in the subcommittee were kind of minor as well. So I hope that the day is here, we're going to act on these, they're all going to pass, and now we have kind of omnibus licensure bill, we weren't going to have one of those, and so maybe just a process comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Any other discussion?
The final point is that Mr. Representative Abler is that neither Representative Wells nor myself that were involved in this particular one had any idea that the license committee wouldn't be continuing to meet. This bill was put in very sufficient time to be addressed this session before the deadline, so we didn't know that was stopping earlier. So I hope you'll support this. Thank you.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Bunn renews her motion on the A1 amendment. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The AO8-1370 amendment, I will move that one. And this actually is something that has come up just in the last few days, members. It has to do with a doctor in Canby, Minnesota, or a hospital in Canby, Minnesota, who is hiring a doctor. As everybody knows, getting doctors out to rural Minnesota is a difficult issue. And what this would do, it actually deals with the doctor's husband, who is also going to be working out in that area. But as you know, couples travel together. And so what this does is allows the doctor's husband to actually continue to work in Canby as well. And it has gone to the board of medical practice, I guess, and they had a meeting on Saturday, and there doesn't seem they don't have a problem with doing this. So I'd ask your help on this. Representative Madison. AO8-1370.
Oh.
Yes. Any questions on this one, members? Okay. Seeing no no questions, no discussion, all in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The A5 amendment.
Members, this is just clarifying some language that already is in law. When hospitals or hospices provide alternative and complementary services, right now, how the law is written, they believe that the hospitals understand that they have to provide a patient bill of rights in addition to what the hospitals already provide. That was not the original intent of the law, is my understanding. And we have worked on the language, and the Department of Health is fine with this language. It basically is saying that the hospitals don't have to provide a separate patient bill of rights in the situation.
I need to.
What's the amendment number?
It's the A3708A5 amendment. The A5 amendment.
A5, okay.
And so, as I understand it, basically, under current law, it could be interpreted that you have to give the Bill of Rights when they enter the inpatient hospital, and also the alternative care person has to give the same Bill of Rights.
Correct.
And this is just to say you only need to have one of them.
Correct.
Representative Ada.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I support the amendment. The plan has talked to me about it, and it makes a lot of sense. I do have a question just to the section for Mr. Hindemeyer while he's here, if I may. You're dozing off there. I had to kind of keep you engaged, Mr. Hindemeyer. Do you have the amendment in front of you? The other amendment,
yes.
On line 1.7, talks about providing a copy of the Bill of Rights and so on. Is it the department? There's been some question about this. Is it the department's view that this is just at the initial stage that they need to provide this Bill of Rights, or is it just the one time they should do this? Is that the department's stance?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, the law is written that the practitioner is to provide the client consumer with a consumer bill of rights at the beginning of their encounters.
Right. I just wanted to clarify, because I thought there was some question before that some of these providers thought they had to do it all the time, but your clear impression is just one time and then that's fine. Just wanted to have you say that. I'm happy. Thank you. That's cute. It's a softball question.
Any other discussion on this? Okay. All right. Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the A5 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? That motion is adopted. The A4 amendment, I think this is the author of the bill, actually.
What do you know?
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is an amendment that would allow pharmacists to provide vaccines for those eligible over the age of 18. And flu vaccine for those over the age of 10. And I do have someone here to speak briefly to the amendment.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Lindu. I'm a pharmacist, and I'm here today with the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. Very simply, currently, pharmacists have the authority to administer flu vaccines to individuals 18 and older. This changes it to allow flu vaccines years 10 and older. All other vaccines to individuals years 18 and older. Currently, pharmacists have authority to enter into a collaborative practice agreement with physicians on a case-by-case basis, and this amendment removes that case-by-case restriction. The amendment is supported, obviously, by pharmacists, by the Board of Pharmacy, the Medical Association, Nursing Association, and the Health Department. We are not aware of anyone in opposition.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, just to speak in favor of the amendment, this is actually my original bill that I did back in the time, I think. And Representative Bond repealed one of my bills, and just to be here a little while, bills come and go. Anyway, so it's quite an expansion, but I think it's reasonable, and it was kind of a start at the time, and now we've moved beyond. So, good bill. We should support it.
Any further discussion, members? Okay, seeing none, all in favor of the A4 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? And just a word on the process piece, and I take that comment seriously. Every single one of these are amendments. We haven't allowed any amendments that have not been agreed to by all the parties and kind of thoroughly vetted and worked out with the department and everybody. So just so people understand that. The last is the A6 amendment, which I will move. Maybe is anybody here that wants to speak?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker. Mr. Chair, just a quick...
Oh, you want to move? Why don't you move this, Representative Walker? Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is just trying to get the marriage and family therapist in line with how we do the licensed psychologists and social workers, their duty to warn legislation. Right now, this chapter provides that mental health professionals have an obligation to warn a potential victim and the appropriate law enforcement agency when a client conveys to a mental health professional of a specific serious threat of physical violence against a clearly identifiable person. And right now, marriage and family therapists aren't required to warn the necessary law enforcement agencies about this particular person. So it's just to bring parity within the mental health system.
Any discussion on this one?
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
this is for marriage and family therapists?
Yes.
Do they know we're working on this today?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is actually their bill that I didn't get a hearing for. We just ran out of time, and so we looked for a vehicle. Thank you, Representative Murphy. And while I'm speaking, the department's okay with this also.
Oh, just, Mr. Chair, it's going to attract a crowd of people, work on marriage and family therapist legislation, and try to help out their world. It's an interesting discussion.
Okay.
Good bill.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Walker renews her motion on the A6 amendment. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Very good. Representative Murphy, is there any further discussion on the bill, members? Anything you want to add?
Mr. Chair and members, I think silence is golden.
Okay. All right, then Representative Murphy renews her motion that House Bill 3708 be passed as amended to the General Register. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion is adopted.
Mr. Chair, members.
The bill goes to the floor. Representative Hilton. Welcome to the committee. I will move that House File 3264 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This was brought to me by Mike Kestner. He is the CEO of State Operated Services, and I'd like to turn it over to him.
Great. Motion to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, my name is Mike Kestner. I'm the Chief Executive of State Operated Services, Minnesota Department of Human Services. What this bill does is actually a relatively small change in the statute around the operation of day training habilitation programs by the Department of Human Services. When this law was first put in place, it expressly requires that the employees of that site be state employees. Technically, then, what that does is for the folks working in the program, if they want to achieve a W-2 form and pay federal income taxes and qualify for things like medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities, they have to become state employees, which was never the intent of the statute. What this does is it allows these people to access that type of service, MAEPD, without becoming state employees.
And that's it.
Any questions? Okay.
Hold on one.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 3264 be passed. We recommend it pass and refer to the General Register. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? That motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Member.
All right. Is Rook Avina here yet? Okay. Members, we're moving along pretty well. We actually have the room till 6 o'clock. We're not going to go that long. So, but we're actually going to break for a short. We're going to break for a short recess for maybe 15 minutes or so. Okay. So we are in recess. Yeah, that's not an invitation.
No, I can pull the microphone down. I'm ready to.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
I'll move House File 3873 be recommended to pass to the Committee on Finance.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's a pleasure. I don't often get to come to.
It's a pleasure to
Health and Human Service, but let me just tell you about this bill. You know, my daughter Ida works for Council, Asset Council 65, and she told me that this was a good bill that protects vulnerable adults' personal information from being given away to managed care plans, you know, for marketing purposes, and that's about all I know what it does. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to introduce Leanne Coonsey from Council 65 to explain it. I don't think there's any known opposition.
And I'm going to offer the A1 amendment, too, just to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. So all in favor of the A1 amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? It's 3873, members. Go ahead. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Rukavina, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Leanne Quincy, and I have 16 years of experience with county government in Carver County, where I worked as a social worker until approximately 2 years ago. For the past 2 years, I've been representing various employees as a staff representative for Greater Minnesota AFSCME Council 65. Council 65 represents most of the 77 counties that fall in our jurisdiction, and we support this bill that would protect against the disclosure of personal information of vulnerable adults maintained by the Department of Human Services to managed care entities who contract with the Department of Human Services to participate in the Special Needs Basic Care Program. As part of these contracts, clients must receive information regarding all plans in their service area. We believe this information should be mailed by DHS to ensure the protection of vulnerable adults' personal information. It appears that without this bill, lists of vulnerable adults' contact information may soon be released by the Department of Human Services to the managed care plans who have contracted with DHS under the Special Needs Care Program. The sole purpose of providing this information to these private entities is to allow the managed care insurance sales departments to market directly to these vulnerable adults. While these contracts restrict what managed care can do with this information, there are no resources for the protection of the vulnerable adult's personal information from further dissemination or misuse. This bill would simply require that the Department of Human Services protect the vulnerable adult's personal information and require that the Department of Human Services mail the information to the vulnerable adults themselves. The information will still get to the vulnerable adults, but the names and addresses of the vulnerable adults will not be given to the managed care entities. I have spoken with representatives of the Disability Law Center and also ARC, and they also support this bill. I have also spoken with the Department of Human Services, and they do not oppose this bill as amended. again, thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Ms. Henry, did you want to? Okay. Do you agree with her? All right. Anybody else that wants to testify on the bill? Okay, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, the amendment that we put on says the health plan shall cover any costs incurred by the commissioner, but according to the bill itself, you've deleted after the period lines 2.33 to 2.35, and prior to that, it says the commissioner is prohibited from providing the names of potential enrollees to the for marketing purposes. I'm kind of not following the reason for the new language being put in there if they're saying it's not going to be allowed.
Representative Anderson, Mr. Chair, the health plans would cover the cost of their marketing materials that would be required under the contract for DHS to provide to potential eligible enrollees, the vulnerable adults, and so the Department of Human Services would incur that cost of mailing the information. However, it would be coming from DHS versus the department providing names and address, contact information, or personal information to the managed care entities and then having them mail out their own marketing materials.
So basically, it's instead of having giving the names to the plans to mail out the materials themselves, the plans would give the materials to the Department of Health, who would mail them out because they have control of the name, so the names aren't getting out to the plan. So is the department here? Did they want to? Okay, Representative Liebling.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I was just, I noted that Representative Anderson looked so confused, and so was I, and that's why I, and so it's, your explanation's helpful. That is helpful. I'm still just, I think the language, though, is still kind of unclear. That I'm not sure that it really says that. I mean, you know, this is happening a little too fast for me to be able to help, but you know, I think there's still a confusion here. I mean, I'm fine with the intent of it, and, you know, I have no problems with the bill, but I just want to make sure it says what we think it should say.
Representative Lawson.
Chair, we have other experts.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Perhaps is there a ponding options that would you want me to fill a little time with?
Why don't we get an answer first?
My name's Ann Henry from the Disability Law Center, and this just applies to the Special Needs Basic Care Plan, which is a new managed care option for people with disabilities. So it's optional. People don't have to sign up for it. What was going to happen is that the department was going to give the names of 95,000 people with disabilities on medical assistance to the variety of health plans in their county, and then those health plans would mail their marketing materials to people. We all on the advisory committee thought that that was not a good idea because these people are not going to necessarily have a relationship with the health plan. And their name, address, disability status, and status with regard to public assistance was going out to entities that they would not have a relationship with. So it is true that the department has to give information to potential enrollees about this option because some people might want to choose it. So what will happen under this is the department's prohibited from giving names to health plans, but it requires the health plans to pay for the cost of DHS mailing the information because DHS is required by other federal regulations to assure that people have the information.
Would it help to clarify to actually define marketing materials to say health plan marketing materials or something like that? Is that where the confusion is coming in?
I think maybe so, Mr. Chair.
That's fine.
Okay, and I don't know if maybe that using the word health plan is probably not exactly what we want to say because I know there's different definitions in law, but...
Well, if I might, though, the first sentence does say they're prohibited from giving names to health plans for marketing purposes, and then the very next sentence says they have the health plans need to cover the cost of mailing the marketing material. So I would think that those connections so close would be clear that we're talking about marketing materials from health plans.
Well, let me suggest this. I think we understand what the issue is, and if we need to clarify on the floor, we can. I get nervous about just using the word health plan because that is defined in statute, and there may be other people that need to mail stuff out. I don't know all the details. So can we just, with the understanding that we want to make sure that this is clear, maybe move forward with it. Representative Laughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Rupazini, this is a great bill. We have, since managed care began for MA, had this same sort of process going because we had reviewed horror stories in other states of how things had happened when it was sort of a free-for-all. But at one time, and I'm not sure if I'm correct or current on this, I know that in Hennepin County, it was costing over $1 million a year to mail those materials out to enrollees. And I'm wondering, when we say the commissioner, if this is really going to be a delegated down to the counties or if this is actually going to be done from DHS. And my second question would be, as we're working on wording about marketing materials, I think uniform informational materials and making informed choices is different than confusing marketing materials. And so I think, particularly for this population, it would be useful as they're making choices to have an ability to really understand what the difference is between all the glossy descriptions and have some uniform comparison.
Would you like to testify?
You want to?
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Pam Parker from the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and I manage this program. The department, the health plans do develop each of their own materials. The department develops other materials that are trying to do the comparison that they will provide also. As far as it going to the county, that is not a county responsibility. This program, the enrollment does not come through the county.
Yeah. And I think one of the advantages that people see in this is that the marketing materials would all go at one time as well with the comparison, so people wouldn't get one day and 1 3 days later. So Representative Liebling.
Oh, Mr. Chair, in the interim here, I had a chance to draft a little language that I could suggest to clarify it. And what I would suggest is inserting another sentence between the one that's that we now have on 2.32 and 2.33 and the one that's in the amendment. And so I guess on the I guess what I would do is move to amend the bill on line 2.35 by adding another sentence as follows. The commissioner may mail marketing materials to potential enrollees on behalf of health plans, in which case, and then I would go to the beginning of the sentence that we now have on our amendment, so it would read, in which case the health plan shall cover any costs incurred by the commissioner, etc. How would that work?
Is there any obligation that they... Okay. And you'll just do that consistent with whatever your obligation is to mail that material. Okay. So, can you repeat that?
Okay. So, starting on line 2.35 of the bill, the sentence would read, the commissioner may mail marketing materials to potential enrollees on behalf of health plans, in which case the health plans shall cover any costs incurred.
In which case?
In which case, and then go into the other sentence as make it one sentence.
Does everybody understand the amendment? It's really almost an amendment to the A1 amendment, any language, but we've already adopted that. So, does everybody understand the amendment?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any discussion to it? All right. All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? That amendment's adopted. Representative Anderson, did you have a question?
No.
Okay. Any further discussion on the legislation? Representative Rukavina, anything else? Okay. Seeing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 3873 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Thiessen, welcome to your own committee.
You're welcome. Thank you. I will move that House File 3438 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
Representative Thiessen moves House File 3438 recommend to pass and be referred to the General Register. I take it you have an amendment you want to do that now?
Yeah, the AOA 1373 amendment is just technical corrections, as I understand it, if we could do that.
Okay, Representative Thiessen moves 1373 to the form that the author wants. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment adopted. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3438 relates to the newborn screening that we have in the state of Minnesota. And we've had newborn screening in the state for quite some time. And just a little bit of background on it. This legislation, and we don't see the whole piece of legislation here, but there's actually a law that we put in place and dealt with quite extensively in the 2003 legislative session. This has existed previously, but in 2003 we did a lot of work in this area. And under Minnesota law, doctors and others who are involved in the birth of children have a duty to test for heritable congenital preventable disorders. And the reason we do that is there are several disorders that people have that are passed on, that children have, that are unknown and not observable to the when they're born, doctors or parents or to anyone. And they're genetic things that are passed on for parents, and oftentimes the parents don't know that they're carriers of these conditions. And so one of the main reasons here for doing this is if we can pick these, identify these conditions early, they're very treatable and people go on and live fully normal lives. But if they're not picked up, they can lead to serious disability and death in some occasions. And so that's really what the newborn screening program is about, and it is happening. There are programs in all the states across the country. And one of the reasons that I'm working on this bill, and I have for several years, is that my son has a condition that was picked up by one of these screens that we wouldn't have known about and could have been fatal to him had we not gotten the notice very early and gotten treatment, and now he's doing just great. But that's kind of the exact example. We didn't know that we carried this gene with us and would not have known what to do had, you know, things gone south. And then they would have to run a lot of tests, and by the time they get done with the tests, you're running into a lot of problems. So that's really what this is about. So as I said, in 2003, this structure was put in place where we have the testing. The testing has been done, but the duty to test. But we also put in protections for parents in the sense of providing notice to them of their options. You know, they can decline to have the testing done. They can opt out of the testing. They can opt out and ask that the samples be destroyed after 24 months. And they can also opt out of using that sample for research and study. And I would say that in the case of research and study, these are for testing, really to make sure that we don't get false positives, developing new tests, genetic tests, those types of things. This is disaggregated so that the name and identifying features related to the sample are not connected to the actual sample. So we had this in place in 2003. So this is actually really current law, stuff the legislature dealt with 5 years ago and earlier. In 2006, we passed a bill related to genetic material in general. And with that law, genetic information and the collection and use of that, and that law swept in the newborn screening, even though we had already established a whole separate structure for dealing with that very specific and unique circumstance. But an administrative law judge ruled that that more general genetic screening law covered newborn screening, or genetic information law covered newborn screening, and so the state is in a situation and struck down some of the newborn screening issues. And so what we're trying to do is to clarify in law that the specific structure that we set up regarding consent and the whole process of the newborn screening program should be dealt with by the thing we put in place for newborn screening and not under the general rules of genetic information. In addition to that, we've worked, the department and others have worked, and I actually had less involvement in this than many others, about beefing up and making more robust the information that we provide to parents about the program so that they really do have information to make the decisions that they decisions about the newborn screening program. And that's what is in Section 2 of the bill. Section 1 is kind of the exemption from the genetic testing piece. Section 2 is the beefed up information provided to parents. And then Section 3 is a report coming back to make sure that one of the concerns here is that the information about the opt-out possibility is not given to parents and not given effectively. And so we're going to have a report back in 2009 that looks exactly at that issue. And if we need to make additional changes to that, we will. I'd like to turn it over to the testifiers just to talk a little bit more about the program.
Thank you. And state your name for the record and you may begin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Joanne Barkas. I am the director of the Public Health Laboratory at the Minnesota Department of Health. I will be very brief because Representative Thiessen did a wonderful job at summarizing the issues at stake. We do screen at the Minnesota Department of Health approximately 73,000 infants each year for about 53 rare and serious medical conditions that are treatable if caught early. Newborn screening is covered under Minnesota Statute 144.125, which requires that all newborns be tested shortly after birth. This statute also states that parents may decline to have this testing done, that the blood samples may be retained by the Department of Health after testing, and that parents be informed of the benefits of retention of the samples. Or parents may elect to have the testing and to have the blood samples and test records destroyed within 24 months. As has already been mentioned, the Genetic Privacy Statute, which was passed in 2006, conflicts with MS 144.125. And so we are proposing changes to clarify that newborn screening is covered under the Newborn Screening Statute, and to add specific language to make it more clear to parents that they can opt out of the research and storage. Mr. Mark McCann, who is with me, is manager of the Newborn Screening Program and will present some of the specifics of the statutory changes.
McCann, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, again, I'm Mark McCann, Program Manager for the Newborn Screening Program at the Public Health Laboratory. This bill, as it's been well clarified, actually, and stated in terms of the intended changes and what we intend to accomplish with this by Representative Thiessen as well as Dr. Barkas. But in respect for your time, I'll be very brief. This bill clarifies collection, storage and use, dissemination of the genetic information and specimens for testing for these heritable and congenital disorders that we do screen for. It clarifies the residual samples and the results and how we can use them for quality assurance, development of new tests, and for inclusive of purposes for both public health practices and related research. It requires us, provides additional protection for parents in terms of informing them with additional options. Those were highlighted by Representative Thiessen. In addition to that, it requires us to come back and report on the success of these implementations in early 2009.
Representative Thiessen, you have any more
questions? Well, and I would just say, I think we do have someone from the March of Dimes here. Is that right? Yes, that's what I thought. Okay.
Representative Griffin, state your name for the record, who you with, and...
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm here on behalf of the March of Dimes Minnesota chapter. And Mr. Chairman, this is the first time this year that I've been told before testifying that we have the room until 6 o'clock, so if I can start with some brief testimony. Representative Walker says no. Mr. Chairman, we are very supportive of the bill, I know that there are going to be some opponents of the legislation that are going to suggest that we need to treat this as a system different from any other system because of the data that's in there. But I want to make sure that you are all aware that newborns do not have the ability to opt in or opt out of systems. And the kinds of diseases that we are talking about here that can be screened and the ability that we have with modern medical technology to prevent problems that can result from phenylketonuria, that can result from hypothyroidism and others that cause mental retardation or blindness or death, it seems to me is something that we just have to take an opportunity to make sure is done and to protect these children. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the March of Dimes National Chapter recognized just a few states, and Minnesota was one of them in 2007, for being the first state to have all of the 29 recommended screens done. We actually do 57 in this state, and we believe that we should continue to do more. And one of the reasons for protecting the data that's coming in here is to make sure that we have the ability to test the new tests that are coming along. And if we don't save the data that we have currently in the system, we won't be able to develop the new tests. And our hope at the March of Dimes is that we will be able to prevent all newborns from having birth defects. That's the goal that we've set. And people may say that's a laudatory goal and we're never going to get there, but there were people that thought the March of Dimes was never going to be able to cure polio, that we're never going to be able to invent something like a neonatal intensive care unit, and we're happy to have funded 9 Nobel laureates that have made immense differences in people's lives and want to urge you to support this bill today. Mr. Chairman, members, if there are other questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Seeing none. Representative Thiessen, do you want to do amendments now or you want to continue with the test?
I think we should... I don't have any more amendments, so
I don't need to do it the other
time. If I could just say just two more things quickly.
Go ahead, Rick.
First, in the packet, there's another a letter from from a parent and physician about this. But I want to stress that I recognize the concerns about the disclosures here and the interest in getting information to people, and I understand where that's coming from. And what I just emphasize is that I do think this is a unique situation, and we need to take a look at it as a specific and unique situation, and that's why this legislation is here. I don't want it to seem as if we're disregarding, or I have any personal disregard for the interests that I think are going to be expressed, but that it's kind of balancing here, and I think on balance, we do better by getting people information and preventing these diseases earlier. So, with that, I guess I'll stop.
I see two amendments authorized by Representative Emmer. Looks like Representative Anderson, you're going
to... I'm going to offer the two amendments for Representative Emmer.
That's fine. Which one you want to take first?
Can we ask the testimony?
Yeah. Should we have... It's up to you. There's, I think, other testifiers.
Well, I was thinking we... Do the amendment. We either get it on or not, and then the testifier could.
I'd rather have the testimony.
You want to do that first?
Yeah,
fine. We'll do that. We do have additional testifier. For the opponent of the bill, if you're ready. I have Ms. Fraze, Mr. Tyler, and Mr. Pritchard. State your name for the record, and then you may continue. Or start.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Twyla Braze, and I'm president of Citizens Council on Healthcare. I understand that the current policy for newborn screening is opt-out. But we believe that the storage and the research on infant blood and DNA should be opt-in, in compliance with the state genetic privacy law. Over the past 10 years, the department has been retaining the blood and DNA of infants without statutory authority. That would be the genetic blueprint of 780,000 infants. And I just want to let you know, this is the number of children whose blood is in a databank or in a DNA warehouse without the consent or the knowledge of the parent. In addition, there are 42,210 children who have had research done using their blood without their parents' knowledge or consent. This blood and this DNA is owned by the state. It is considered government property. As I said, currently 42,000 of these children have been participants in genetic research, and their parents do not know. The parents were not asked, and to this day, they do not know. The department will tell you that the samples that they gave away were anonymized. We do not know exactly why identifying information was removed, but we do know that genomic experts are now saying that in the emerging world of rich data sets and various public and private electronic databases, no one should believe that anonymization is possible. Some, like Stanford professor Henry Greeley, who spoke 2 weeks ago at the Neurogenomics Conference at the University of Minnesota, believe that anonymization is unethical. It doesn't allow people to withdraw from the study, and it forces people to participate in research they may find highly objectionable. We do not know what kind of research will be approved today or in the future by our government officials. We do not know how the genomic blueprint of children could be used now or in their adulthood, but we do believe that parents should be allowed to make a fully informed choice before their DNA, their child's DNA, is kept and research is done. Parents, in the fog of labor and delivery and in the exhaustion of the postpartum period, should not be expected to look through various documents and find the one that will protect their child's DNA and genetic code from becoming state property. They don't even know that they should be looking for it. So we ask for explicit, informed parent consent for the retention of infant blood and for genetic research. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Tyler, before we start, just keep in mind of the time strain we're both on. Everyone's on, so. State your name for the record and make.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Tyler. I'm testifying primarily as a private citizen, although I am on the Board of Citizens Council on Healthcare as well as a pilot. I would like to testify in opposition to the bill for the reasons that Ms. Braze just mentioned in particular. And I think, having overheard prior testimony on the Senate side on the same bill, the representative or senator carrying the bill was asked, you know, what's the advantage of keeping a genetic a DNA warehouse? And she basically said, well, it's cost containment issues. I mean, by keeping medical data like this and DNA data on children, we can do cost containment and so forth. And I would just like to just ask the representatives on this committee, specific to the retention of DNA on a long-term basis without positive opt-in consent. So to remind Wanda a little bit about what genetic testing can do on a long-term basis and the implications it can have for cost containment. What does that mean? Does that mean parents of future children might be approached by the Department of Health or receive information as to why they shouldn't have future children because they might be predisposed to some kind of genetic problem? I think, does that mean that individuals that may have a propensity for incarceration, perhaps, or violence or other types of things that may occur because of their DNA, their parental DNA, that ultimately might affect the cost of the state, etc., might those things be brought up to a parent and perhaps discourage them from having future children because their parents may have these conditions? From a cost containment perspective, that's the kind of thing that parental opt-in, I think, is very, very important that people be aware of this type of thing. Cost containment, DNA data banks without parental consent. I would suggest that the opt-in provision with regard to provisions of the DNA data bank are exactly where they belong. Opt-in, parental opt-in on behalf of their children. I think that is perfect. I think there is no reason to be afraid of parental opt-in as far as this type of thing is concerned. The other aspect of this is that the main reason for cost containment, I would suggest to the members of this committee that if we're looking for cost containment as far as various government programs or whatever, that this is not the area to be looking for it. I mean, there are areas within the private sector that are experiencing significant healthcare cost containment very successfully in the private sector with a tremendous track record. Even over the last several years, there have been a tremendous track record that might be brought to the publicly insured population to help save literally billions of dollars if you look there. So putting scenarios in front of people where opt-in or opt-out, is not the way to go.
I think on the topic of the bill.
I am, because this is the components of this say cost containment of the VARS Genetic Data Bank is the main reason for keeping the data. And I'm suggesting there are things that are more effective at cost containment than creating genetic data banks on infants. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Richard, welcome to the committee.
Richard.
Sorry, my English is not as good as...
No, it's close enough. Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council. Just very briefly, we want to address the retention of data and the research on the data. That's our concerns, and we, too, support an opt-in, a written opt-in on the part of parents. We believe that this, by forcing parents to opt-in, you're putting the burden on them rather than the state or the government to understand what's going on and exercise their rights, and we think that this, in a sense, circumvents parental authority in some ways by putting this burden on them. From a personal experience where I've been in tests and other things where they've come to me and asked for my consent, these are private providers of health care. And yet here we have the state, and I think you've got a lot of other issues as a result. So we believe that the burden shouldn't be on the parents to try to figure out what's going on, but to put parents back in control, their authority over their children, and so that they get a consent from that. And obviously most parents would probably consent, but we think the burden should be on the state rather than the parents. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the testifier, Representative Ava?
Mr. Chair, I don't know who the question is for. Maybe for the department, and maybe the testifiers want to comment. Maybe is there someone from the department here that can tell me about this? I'm trying to figure out this retention question, and I remember this discussion for many years. On the bill, page 1.13, it says maybe sort of only for a period of time that they've been given consent, and then on the next page it talks about 24 months on line 210. Can you describe, can somebody tell me how long they keep this, and is it not 24 months, is it forever, and is it all that?
Mr. Chair, there's two different statutes you're looking at. The on the page one, the piece you quoted is our general genetic information statute, and that's what that rule is about. The 144.125 is specific to newborn screening. So the short answer is they do keep the information for 124 months.
Thank you. But why does it say 24 months on 210 then?
Mr. McCann? Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, 24 months is a federal requirement for retention of information as it pertains to a laboratory test performed. We do allow parents, as of today, they can download a form and request immediate destruction of the dried blood spot specimen. We do not, are not required by federal law to retain those results for 2 years.
Okay, but so I'm just trying to reconcile the testimony here because I'm kind of rusty on this part of it. So if they pick option two, that's the short version of the current law, but they can just not do it. That's choice one.
Yes.
They do the full meal deal, which is you keep it forever or whatever, a long time, or they do the not have it, or they do the 24-month version. They can pick small, medium, large. Is that, clear?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, to state it slightly differently, parents in Minnesota can decline to have the test performed. It's a rare elected option, but it does happen. Parents often choose to have the testing performed, but elect to have the government, public health, not store their information of those test results and or destruction of the dried blood spot specimen. This particular bill includes a third level of opt-out consent, the research portion. Parents will have that additional opportunity, which they have implied by the destruction of the dried blood spot anyway.
So the people that are keeping the blood 10 years are people that didn't pick option one or two. Is that right? And so, and this bill actually seems to strengthen that information people would get about now even more options than that. But under current law, do they get a form at the beginning? I remember this discussion, just trying to keep track. So the people might have had some expectation to know that it was going to be kept longer than 24 months when they had the test done, although they're kind of busy at the time, but is that right?
Mr. Chair and members, as part of our in the nursery active health education currently, which we do in the form of these brochures, English, Spanish, as well as for the culturally appropriate Amish, we inform parents to date of their rights, inclusive of their ability to opt out and the fact that we do conduct and collaborate with researchers on these dried blood clot specimens.
All right, Reston Gotwell. All right, Reston Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, those brochures, do you have a form along with that then that you give to the parent when they test or have their child tested to do exactly what you're asking here in the bill?
Mr. Chair and representatives, the standard for hospital-based birth care provision is to typically have a list of different types of information checklists that needs to be conveyed to expectant parents, including newborn screening. Those packages typically include the right to destruct forms.
So, Mr. Chair, that form, the form that is available to the parents when they, before the children are tested.
That's how we educate the medical providers out there in the birth care arena. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. I don't see any more questions. Why don't we go ahead with the amendment, Representative Anderson?
Oh.
Are there? Are there additional testifiers that, okay, why don't we hold that a little bit, Representative Anderson, we're pretty close, why don't the testifiers state your name for the record, and just keep in mind that I like to keep everything probably within a minute with each testifier.
I'll do my best.
State your name for the record. And you.
Thank you, Chair members. My name is Dr. Lisa Scimenti. I'm a medical physician at the University of Minnesota, and I'm a specialist in the care of children with genetic and metabolic conditions. I want to thank you for letting me speak here today. I want to share my experiences with you so you understand the importance and the impact of newborn screening and how it saves lives. When I was training back in the early 1990s and began my career as a metabolic specialist at UCLA, children with metabolic disease came to me not because they came to clinic. I saw them in the ICU. These were children who had metabolic acidosis, were in shock, frequently were in coma, and were dying. And as they were in the process of being resuscitated by heroic efforts, we were making the diagnosis of metabolic disease. And this is the way it was. In 2002, I came to Minnesota, and Minnesota already had expanded newborn screening. And it's a totally different world. In this case, kids are diagnosed shortly after birth. If they're sick shortly after birth, we can intervene very rapidly because we know what we're dealing with. We're not doing a million tests and trying to guess why this baby's sick or why this baby's dying. We know up front, right there, why this child is ill. And we can jump in and make appropriate interventions. And some of these diseases have really funny names, like medium chain acyl-CoA dehydrogenase deficiency or methylmalonic acidemia. How many of you have heard of these conditions? And you know what? Parents haven't either. And when I talked to parents and told them I was coming to talk, they told me that if they had the option to opt, they had the opt-in option, many of them wouldn't have opted in because these diseases have such funny names and they've never heard of them. They would feel that this doesn't impact me. This isn't important for me. But they wanted me to tell you that it does impact them, that their children's lives were saved by newborn screening. And had someone gave them the choice, they may have declined and may have lost their child in the process. I want to say that this has just been the most amazing thing for us, for the citizens of Minnesota. The first group of children that I took care of as a new faculty member at the University of Minnesota will be starting kindergarten this year. And these are kids who have normal intelligence that we've been able to treat when they're sick. What typically happens in metabolic disease, if they get the flu, you know, what do you do when your child gets the flu? You give them Pedialyte and you kind of sit with them and walk them through it. You don't do it with these kids. These kids will crash and burn and end up in an ICU. We admit them and give them IV fluids. We give them medication. They get over their flu-like illness. They go home. If we didn't know they had MCAD or some of these diseases, we wouldn't know, and these kids would be the kids you hear these stories. Oh, he just had the flu, he started vomiting, and then he died 2 days later. So this is a a test that makes a huge difference and has saved a lot of lives in Minnesota. So I want to urge you that we need to keep this law the way it is, that families may not have the opportunity to really weigh things and will decline a test that could save their child's life. I also want to make an important point that for some families who English is not their first language, who are poor, who aren't educated, it's going to create a big disparity. There's a study in Massachusetts recently for newborn hearing screening, and what they found is for families that their children were from lower socioeconomic groups or from other groups, those kids were not receiving the full benefit of the hearing screening in those states. So I urge you not to make changes and leave the law the way it is and let families and let babies be screened in Minnesota.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Logan Spector. I'm a colleague of Dr. Scimenti's at the Department of Pediatrics at the U, and I'm a childhood cancer epidemiologist. Dr. Scimenti has spoken very movingly about the benefits of opting out or keeping the opt-in for testing for metabolic problems. I want to talk about the further research use of the spots. We know from some very elegant experiments in other jurisdictions that keep spots that you can detect the signs of childhood leukemia in newborn samples. Only learn this because they were retained. This particular example is one way that we could use the spots to develop a new screening test. For instance, identifying those children who have an extremely high risk of childhood leukemia and preventing them from getting overt disease. I think that's the reason that we want to retain the spots is to be able to expand the list of disorders for which we are able to save children. I agree with Dr. Scimenti that if we have opt-in instead of opt-out, it is the most vulnerable Minnesotans who are going to be hurt, the ones who may not take the time to read the literature and may not understand what it is that they would be agreeing to do. I also want to note that there are several states that keep spots for 20 years or more. These include California, Indiana, Michigan, North Carolina, New Jersey, New York, Ohio, Rhode Island, and Washington State. So far as I know, there's never been any sort of privacy violation of the sort imagined by the opponents of this bill. Indeed, our nation's health departments, and Minnesota's especially, are trusted stewards of all manners of private information, whether it be about pregnancy, cancer, or HIV status. So I think that it is in our best interest for the state of Minnesota and for the health of all children to have opt-out options for newborn testing and storage.
Listener Gutwell, we will take questions right after this last question.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Amy Witherberry, and I'm a PhD student at the University of Minnesota, and I study the causes of childhood cancer along with Dr. Spector. And I'm also a lifelong citizen of the state of Minnesota and a recent mother. I have a 14-month-old son. And I wanted to point out that I see two key concerns with an opt-in approach to consent. First, I'm concerned that parents will fail to opt-in because they are unaware and or uninformed about the importance and the practice of screening tests. Or they simply may not perceive that their child is at risk, and they just don't see how a sample from their healthy child could be used to help others who are not. The second concern is that we cannot predict the future. None of us knows if our children will be diagnosed with a serious disease or if their blood spots could be useful either for their own care or for the care of others. The blood spots are a rich resource, as Dr. Spector already said, that can provide information about what a child might have been exposed to during the later stages of pregnancy. Our research group has worked with the Minnesota Department of Health over the past several years and, with the consent of mothers, has been able to receive spots from specific children. There are many possible factors we can look at in these spots. I also wanted to comment that in our nationwide studies, we find that the vast majority of mothers of childhood cancer cases are highly motivated to participate in this type of research. Even though it won't benefit their child, it may help further the scientific understanding of their children's disease, or it may help other children in the future. And to do this kind of research, we need to be able to have a comparison group. We need to compare children who get cancer with children who do not get cancer. And so to do this, we need to have data and specimens available from a representative sample of the population. Therefore, it is important to me as a mother that my child's spot, whether he is healthy or not in the future, is available down the road for this type of investigation. Therefore, I'd like to close by saying that there are many research situations where active consent is warranted, but I don't believe this is one of them. Without implied consent, children will inevitably go undiagnosed and the vital research could cease. Thank you for this opportunity.
Just clarification, Ms. Dr. Schmitty, when you said you don't want the law to change, you meant you support this legislation, right?
I want the program to be the way it is right now, where parents don't need to opt in.
I saw there's one more testimony. Why don't we go with Reverend Gout? No, you okay? We'll take the testifier. Go ahead, state your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Margaret Miniger. I'm a mother, and I'll try to speak just real briefly. My concern is the blood that is stored and the research done. I'm not debating that this is a good or a bad thing. I think it definitely has some benefits. But I must say that organ donor cards is also a benefit, yes? And we sign for that. We give our permission to do that. The other thing that I'd like to say is it definitely should be opt-in as a parent. We should know what we are doing. I apologize, I'm really nervous.
That's fine. We're regular folks, too.
I understand that.
We're just as nervous as you are.
But basically, I just want to say, give us the option. Most of us are smarter than you think, and a lot of us will opt to do that. And so for right now, that's what I'd like to say. Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you. Reverend Gatwa?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, and I think the difference here is the opt-in versus opt-out, and as a matter of state policy, are we going to assume that parents aren't going to do what's right by their kids given the proper information, and therefore the state must step in and do it on their behalf, or else terrible things are going to happen to their children? I'm a parent of 5 children. I was present for all their births. If I knew these things were being done, that spots were being kept, blood samples are being kept, and I knew that they would do good and that information were provided to me, I can certainly think in terms of making an informed decision on behalf of my child and deciding to do it or not to do it. The onus, if we do what's being asked, then falls to the healthcare providers to help educate parents so that they make the right choices for their kids. But I think we, as a matter of state policy, need to have ultimate respect for parents' rights on behalf of their kids. It is their choice what happens with samples of their tissues. And as technology advances and science advances, this is going to become more and more of an issue. What are we doing with the substance of our bodies? It is going to become a very big issue because there's a lot we can do with those things. I understand the whole opt-out piece, and therefore it becomes automatic that these things are done to our kids and samples are held for more than 2 years. One question I had of any of the testifiers is there an immediate, I get the whole thing about caring for kids right away. You want to be able to ask some information to treat them if something comes up very quickly. When they've just been newborn, they're in the nursery area, or something comes up, you need that data immediately. But I'm not understanding the need to hang on to samples, dry blood spots, for many years. You said some states hold them for 20 years. I can understand where that might be beneficial for some things, but is there an absolute need to do it that wouldn't require an education of the parents and their consent?
Mr. McKay? Mr. Chair, Representative, these are very rare disorders that we deal with. Some of them are 1 in 150,000, 1 in 100,000. As an aggregate that we're currently screening for, it's about 1 in 500. When we are in the process of quality assurance, quality control, quality improvement, having an archive like a dry blood spot archive allows us to better improve existing testing methodology to reduce false positives, meaning reduce parents freaking out when we have a false positive result drop in their lab, meaning we want a better ability to predict disease for these rare disorders. Newborn screening dry blood spot archive is critical. The better programs out there, including Minnesota, have taken steps to use a resource like this with privacy protections. Parents can opt out anytime during this process. And if there's any ever linked identifying information to one of these studies as we develop new tests or improve testing, we already require, it's a federal requirement, parental consent to opt in with any linked information. It's not a requirement for an anonymized or de-identified or no private health information associated type of study. Preston, got one?
Mr. Chair, into the testifiers. When I was going through prenatal screen, not prenatal screenings, but prenatal tests and so forth with our children and my wife, we were asked many times by the doctor, here's what we're thinking of doing, do you want us to do that? And so information was given to us with which we made decisions. Is that a bad model? Is that something that we're not trusting of?
Mr. Chair, representatives, it's an excellent model. Currently at the Minnesota Department of Health in the Newborn Screening Program, we've created a separate unit for communication and education. The tool that we've been using in the nursery is really a poor time to educate parents about their rights, but it's also, on a practical basis, a good time to educate parents. But we absolutely agree that, and we've actually made steps, and we're seeing some real fruit of it, actually. Senator Scheid had some good testimony saying that her daughter, who had a recent birth last week, the prenatal educator had actually educated them and talked to her about newborn screening, which was great fruit to see, because we started this up last spring. But we intend to go very aggressive on prenatal health education, very aggressive on general education. We want to get it across the board, and not only just do it kind of in the one-time, two-time category, we want to sustain this. And that's our goal, is to take opt-out consent. It's working here in Minnesota. It works well, and to make it even better.
Representative Gottwald, one more time.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I think that the onus is again on us from a policy perspective. I realize there's work involved in informing parents, but that is respectful of that ultimate role of the parent. If we want to have opt-out, that's different than opt-in, obviously. And I think giving information to parents, doing that prenatally, and we've already heard testimony that suggests that can be done, is being done, give the information to the parents and let them opt-in. They can make that decision and ought to be left in charge of those decisions for their children. I think it's very presumptuous and a slippery slope for us to go down to start adding more to this opt-out approach.
That's a... Representative Gottwald, that's a very good question, and the committee will kind of decide what route we want to go with that. I believe we have a couple of amendments. Representative Emmer?
We do, Mr. Chairman. I would at first move the A6 amendment. To the amendment, Mr. Chair?
Yes, to the amendment, and then explain it, and we'll take vote up or down.
I will, and if you'll give me just a little leeway. First, I've offered this amendment, or a form of it, and then the next one, in another committee. And I would say that I respect Representative Thiessen's passion for this newborn screening. And he and I think, have had many conversations where I think it's pretty clear where we differ. And I think Representative Gottwald has hit on it very well. I think that the road that we're going down, and you'll notice, by the way, on the amendment, Representative Thiessen, what I've done is I believe that there should be an opt-in. I think that this is a huge mistake for the government to be telling parents that they're going to have to be wary enough and figure it out. I don't believe the opt-in is working the way the witnesses believe it is. There's just so much paper that's provided to these parents when they're going through the process. They need to be able to opt in. I mean, would you want to have an opt-out for an or to opt in? I mean, would you want to have an opt-out for an organ donation? Would you want to have an opt-out for a hernia repair? These are surgeries that you don't have to have.
you don't need them, but a doctor would tell you maybe it's really important that you have them. No, under this scenario, apparently those we require upfront, full and final, if you will, consent, but we don't allow it for newborn screening. That part aside, what I've decided to do, and I've asked Representative Peace in the chair to give it some consideration, is take out that piece on newborn screening, because I just don't think we're going to agree on that, the opt-in versus the opt-out. We already have the opt-out. So what I've done is try to approach it from the standpoint of the research piece, the genetic research. I listened to the testimony just a couple minutes ago about, well, this is great because it helps us work on our testing procedures. You don't need it for 20 years. I mean, you've got a warehouse full of these blood spots going back 20 years. It would seem to me a short period of time would probably be more beneficial to your testing. Although I don't mean to do your job, what I've done here is simply say that if you're going to use that stored material for any research, and now I've narrowed it way down, I'm asking that you provide, or you obtain, I'm sorry, consent, prior informed written consent of the parent or guardian of the infant. And I would only add, Mr. Chairman, and before I hear from Chair Thiessen, that we're not just taking material on the kids. We're also keeping genetic material of the parents. So this goes beyond just the children, and it would seem to me that everybody would have an interest in getting consent before their material is used for some unknown and perhaps unwanted research. And with that, I'd ask for a roll call on it, too.
Representative Thiessen, do you have comments on this amendment? Or?
Yeah, well, first of all, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, President Emmer did talk to me about this in advance, and I appreciate the effort to kind of figure out a place to land here between us. I'm not sure that we have, and what I told him is, you know, I don't think that this gets us there for practical reasons, among other things, but that we can continue to work on this issue related to research. And I think what the reason that we've learned, and I think we heard a little bit of testimony about this, or what we know, is that there is a difference between an opt-out and an opt-in from a research reliability perspective. And Mr. Stein has stated that, particularly for developing new screening tests and getting after the false positive issue, you know, these are very rare circumstances that they happen, and so it helps to have the body of knowledge, the body of research stuff there to do the testing. And again, this is disidentified, disaggregated testing. And the witness had previously said, if we're going to do identified testing, that does require an opt-in. And so I just think if there's a way that we can get at this issue, maybe after 20, I don't know if there's a practical way we can get at this issue so it's not held on forever for some people, and get it, or we can get an opt-in for that, perhaps we can get there. I don't think that we have gotten there with this amendment yet, and I'm willing to work with them to try to figure that piece out if there's a practical way to get there.
All right, clerk, take the roll.
I'm opposing the amendment right now.
Powell?
No.
Thiessen?
No.
Abler?
Yes.
Anderson?
Yes.
Rod?
Yes.
Bunn?
No.
Emmer?
Yes.
Finstead? Fritz? Gottwald?
Yes.
Hamilton?
Yes.
Huntley?
No.
Liebling?
No.
Loeffler?
No.
Murphy?
No.
Norton?
No.
Otremba? Rood?
No.
Kemper?
No.
Walker?
No.
Seven ayes, 11 no. Amendment not adopted. Representative Emmer, I believe you have another one.
I do. I would move the A7 amendment.
Go ahead and explain the amendment and then...
Well, this one's pretty simple. It requires a Tennyson warning, which for those of you that don't know, is a warning that is in the Government Data Practices Act, 1304 Subdivision 2. It says that an individual asked to supply private or confidential data concerning the individual shall be informed of, one, the purpose and intended use of the requested data within the collecting government entity, two, whether the individual may refuse or is legally required to supply the requested data, three, any known consequence arising from or supplying or refusing to supply the data, and four, the identity of other persons or entities authorized by state or federal law to receive the data. It would seem to me that this is one that we can all agree on. This is simply giving people the information that's consistent with the opt-out situation.
Representative Thiessen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the first thing I would say is, in some sense, this, I think we're getting close to doing this already. I think that the information we provide hits those four things. The thing that people have to remember, I think, is that this is not the Department of Health that is actually collecting this information. It's the hospitals, the midwives, the people that are actually there at the birth, the providers. And so, in that sense, it's not the government at that point collecting the information. So, again, I'm just not sure of all the implications of this. I'm willing to work again with you because I actually think the stuff that is provided currently is consistent with the Tennyson warning. I want to talk to the hospital to figure out what if there's other implications here. I just don't know if it's happening.
I would appreciate that, Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen. The point of the Tennyson warning, though, is that it is clear and concise. The material, in fact, that was just passed out, it gets to that problem that I'm talking about. When you go in and you're involved in the process, I think Representative Gottwald was talking about being there. I think everybody in here at one time has probably been there. You just get inundated with paperwork. A Tennyson warning, the material is being collected for government purposes. The reason that I'm offering it this way is because you're right. Without this in your proposal, the private agencies are not necessarily subject to that. But it is being collected for the government purpose. And all I'm asking for, and I take it that you're not in favor of it tonight, is the standard Tennyson warning, which is a very clear and concise 1, 2, 3, 4, as opposed to spread out through all kinds of paperwork.
And I understand that, and I would oppose it at this time, but I see where you're going. I'll work with you more on this.
Can I have a roll call on that?
Roll call, Mr. Chair? Call?
Thank you so much.
Clerk, take the roll.
Howe.
No.
Thiessen.
No.
Abler.
Yes.
Anderson.
Yes.
Rod.
Yes.
Bunn.
No.
Emmer.
Yes.
Finstead. Fritz.
No.
Gottwald.
Yes.
Hamilton.
Yes.
Huntley.
No.
Liebling. Loeffler.
No.
Murphy.
No.
Norton.
No.
Otremba.
No.
Hess. Rood.
No.
Shumper.
No.
Walker.
No.
Otremba. No.
Six ayes, 11 noes, amendment not adopted. Representative Abel, to the bill.
Yeah.
Okay. This is a good discussion, I think. Can I, not to overdo what everybody already said, but I talking to these other opt-in, opt-out things, it's amazing to me. You know, we've had this discussion of some heated rainstorms last year or whenever it was, and the Department of Health, and you know, they just to the, not to the author, but to the Department of Health, and as they bring these things forward, now people will be surprisingly cooperative. You let them know what they're in for. You know, if it's record locator service data about what clinics they've been to, and I'm not opening that issue today. but this stuff here where people want their kids to be well cared for. And they're surprisingly able to tell you that, their view, if you let them. I just wanted to comment about the, and before I get to my last point, this bill makes this situation better. If this bill doesn't pass, Representative, well, nothing to talk about on the floor for more amendment vehicles, for one thing. But actually beyond that, entertainment device and good debate that'll come out of that, there'll be less freedom and information for the parents. So this bill does some good, and so I'm going to vote for the bill, and I'm going to support it on the floor. So we should do that today. But I was looking at this Omni thing. This quilt on here, a little thing. It's really cute. On page 5, it finally gets down to the disclosure of you might want to know what's going on. It just says if you refuse to have your baby's blood tested, or you object to the Minnesota Department of Health storing your baby's card and newborn screening results, you must sign a form. That's all it says about all this stuff. And as I skimmed it, I didn't get the idea that it's 24 months or 10 years, or it's going to be used for research, or it's going to be held like 10, 20. I mean, it wasn't clear at all. And so I realized now I'd be writing a new brochure. But I think even when you write this stuff, it's okay to tell people, you know, we're going to keep it a long time, and we might use it for research. It might save lives. And they're like, I think I'd like kids' blood to save a life someday, and they would just do that. So it's you need to respond. You want to respond, you can, but there's mostly a comment. And I'll stop.
Mr. Chair and
Mr. McCann.
Representative Abler, good call. Good deep dive on that. The English brochure that we've just redeveloped has inclusive information about storage and research in it. We haven't caught up with the Spanish or the Amish versions. The Amish versions, we actually have staff rolling them on their own. They're hand tying with those beautiful black bows.
Thank you. I have Preston Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, we seem to have an unfortunate trend sometimes with issues that we don't want to tell parents real information about what is going on with their children. And I'm relating it somewhat to an issue that you all know that I've been working on for a while in vaccines. You know, the argument against those things is often, if you give people information, they won't do what they should do. Or if you give people information, they'll be scared away. But there's nothing scarier than not telling people what's going on with their kids. And there's nothing scarier than finding out something about a procedure that was done on your child after the fact. So, we have to at some point trust parents to do what's right for their kids. And also, I think, in following up with Representative Abler's comments, to get the fact that there's a bigger picture out there. And that it might not be their kids that's impacted, but gosh, it could help somebody else. And I think parents would be inclined to go that direction. But Mr. Chairman, I do have a question related to the Minnesota Department of Health information on the parental refusal of screening. On the last page, number 6, when I read the law itself, on the back page, it's not new language, but essentially it's saying that there has to be a opt-out by parents or guardians. But when you look at the Department of Health information, it says you have to have a parent and a witness sign the form. So not only are we not giving parents, you know, the ability to make that decision to opt in, but we're not trusting them once again, and we're essentially having somebody else look over their shoulder. So I'm trying to figure out what the role of the witness is and why we can't just, I mean, for goodness sake, trust parents on this one.
Mr. McCann, Mr. Chair, Representative, very good point. The reason we have that witness provision is just really to authenticate that they are the parent. Oftentimes, we have requests for destruction of the dried blood spots well after they come out of the home. They're well after the birthing care representative or hospital-based doctor or nurse has interacted with them. It might be a home-based decision when their child is 1 or 2 or 3 years old. And we just want to be able to authenticate that they are the parent. The reason is we've had a fair number of parents actually write in and request to never, we don't even have a process for this, but to never destroy their dry blood spot. And we just want to make sure that there's no legal issues about somebody wanting it destroyed, maybe one of the parents versus the other. It was authentication parent was which worked.
Members, I just want to remind everyone we still have a couple of very contentious bill after this. We have about 45 minutes. I'm going to try to keep it pretty tight, Representative Emma. Representative Broad, did you have some follow-up?
Well, I was just going to do a follow-up. I mean, I'm looking through these forms, and it talks about within the first 24 hours of life, and you know, it seems to me that you're pretty clear who the parent is while they're at the hospital. So maybe there's a way to distinguish between those who have left and those who haven't. But it just seems to me that that's an exceptional oversight over parents.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, most of this is the first part of it is Health East documents and their policy is the hospital document. But the form is from the department, and I think the witness in this case is the nurse who is actually walking through. As you'll see in the Health East piece, they have to actually verbally and inform the person about, you know, and talk about this stuff. And so the witness would be the medical professional who's there and just signs up. I mean, part of this is a record keeping thing.
All right, Representative Emmer, then we'll go to Representative Stumper.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Thiessen, the witnesses, you know, thank you for the handout. I should have seen this before. I'm sure I have. But when I put that Tennyson warning together the first time, I wish I would have been looking at this. If you could turn to this opt-out instructions page. Number 3 says inform parent about, and then it says data privacy protection. I think we do need to work on this more. Because I think, and I apologize for offering the amendment, because I think it's already required by law. And if it hasn't been provided, my concern is the standard Tennyson warning has not been provided. I'm wondering what kind of problems the department could have. So I'd love to be involved in finding out more information about how the department has helped providers comply with this and make sure that they're not on the wrong side of the law with the department.
I see heads nodding, so it looks like they'll be working with you on that.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Representative Stumper.
Okay.
Not seeing any more. Representative Rude. Very good. Let's all those in favor of House File, what are we on? 3438. Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Bill, as amended, adopted. As amended, yes. Representative Walker will bring up House File.
House File
1724. Representative Walker adopts the committee report.
You have to adopt the committee report, Mr. Chair.
I move the committee, my own committee report.
All those in favor.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 And then, Mr. Chair, I'll move House File 1724.
Okay. I think we are moving this to finance because it's on fees. Health finance, so. Go ahead, Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We're not having testimony tonight. This was testimony in your subcommittee. And from my understanding, while I was chairing Chair Huntley's committee, you were busy working with both sides of the individuals on this particular issue. And I look forward to seeing your amendment that you're going to work on.
Representative Walker, why don't you briefly explain the bill, and then I'll give my
The bill itself is something that myself and Representative Abler have been working on for 5-6 years now. Right now, we have a variety of individuals that practice different forms of natural medicine that range anywhere from individuals having 1 month of online services to 30 years of training. We have individuals that have gone through a curriculum that is instructed by the naturopath community around medicine. We have individuals that have are midwives and things of that, practicing naturopathic medicine. And in Minnesota, we have about 25 or 26 individuals, many more throughout the country, that have gone through this curriculum that are physicians, and trying to distinguish them through a registry to make sure that there is some type of distinction between those individuals that have gone through some medical training, making sure that individuals can see a difference. And so with the help of Chair Tao, through the licensing committee, move from a licensure request to a registry, making sure that there is a distinction.
Members, when we were here for the finance committee, there was an agreement made between the two parties on principle. It was done in the last hour or so we don't have time to draft an amendment to address that. There's been an agreement made between the principal, and I committed to work with the two groups on that principle to move this bill forward, unless things have changed since then. But with that said, Representative Shumper, and then we'll go with Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chairman and members, we just want to be explicit about this agreement that the traditional naturopathic people are expecting us, I guess you and I, to come up with an amendment to be offered on the floor of the House to clarify this.
Representative Shumper, we're going to go to finance, so you even have one extra step.
We can try it there. Okay, just let's understand.
That is, the understanding is to make sure that the naturopath doctors could be carved out in their own little section, and the naturopath would be able to practice what they currently practice today. And we're going to work on language to make that explicit. So, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, those who worked on the bill. My concern is the scope of practice that's in the bill right now, and I take it that my understanding from what you're talking about is you're going to deal with both sides and work with the scope of practice, because I can see the way it is right now is you're going to exempt a bunch of people out of the picture as far as naturopathic goes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, yeah, and actually when we say we're working at two groups, there were three groups because the MMA was involved, and we've handled most of their concerns, and so now it's dealing with the other side and making sure that the scope of the amendment that
Representative Anderson, the current bill in front of you is the agreement with the MMA, so this is a three-group agreement. It's very difficult to get that. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, in the title of your bill, it doesn't even reference the bill or the section of law 146A as far as what was the... Oh, man, it must have been back when Representative Carruthers was in the legislature. Mm-hmm. And I know that others have worked on this bill in the past, but I'm concerned that we don't include that section of law in the title when we come. So just to put that on record and let people know that we will be looking at that for future. So thank you.
Representative Huntley.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I just have a few comments that people might pay attention to before it comes to my committee. I'd be, and this is a very serious issue. We're talking about licensure. That means the state approves this, and so if you vote for this, you're saying you approve of this practice. I'll need to know when it gets to my committee if the patients can sue their naturopathic provider if there has been either malpractice or if going to the naturopathic provider has prevented them or delayed their getting the appropriate medical treatment. I'll want to have some answers to that. I will say that we're sort of in the process in most of the healthcare system and moving towards evidence-based medicine, and a lot of what's in this bill goes in just the opposite direction. And some of us are old enough to remember Steve McQueen, who had to go to Mexico to get Laetril from apricot pits. if any physician did that today, they'd lose their license instantly. Is that going to be okay with this bill? I would also say that the Steve Jobs from Apple Computer in the last 2 years tried naturopathic medicine and then ultimately gave it up for his tumor and went to a regular medicine. And the third and last thing I'll be interested in discussing is why naturopaths believe in homeopathy, since homeopathy has no basis in science and is the complete opposite of science. And we've had people testify in my committee what homeopathy means, and what it really means is diluting something 1 to 10,000, then diluting it again 1 to 10,000, and then diluting it again 1 to 10,000, until they will admit there is not a single molecule of what they started with left in that solution, but it's still great because the water molecules remember what was in there. So if you want to support a group that believes in homeopathy, and it's in their bill on page 3, line 8, that's what they believe in. And they've come to this committee and testified that that's what they believe in.
And I have not exaggerated what the homeopathy is.
Members, it's not a fully licensure bill. It's a certification, but I definitely will get his date.
And his answers, Mr. Chair.
And his answers. So, okay. All those in favor of House File 1724, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
The ayes have it. Bill adopted. Off to finance.
It ain't over.
All right. The last, I think it's done, right? Are we done? The last item on the agenda is House File 599, which the committee passed to the General Register last spring. It was returned to the committee because it wasn't acted on in the floor like others, and the motion is to re-refer this back to the General Register. And so is there a discussion? Assembly Lee.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I guess I would want to, when we, well, first of all, I think I need to, do we have a copy of the bill here in the packet? Maybe if we could just give me a second to find that. I guess, first of all, I'd like to know if the bill is in the same form as it was in when it was left this committee, because there were some, I suppose it would be. I mean, there were some amendments that were offered on the floor that, if I remember right, were eventually withdrawn, but I guess I'd kind of like to know for sure if that's the case, if this is in its original
form. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Liebling, yes, this bill is in its original form. The amendment that was offered on the floor was an attempt to help ease some concerns, but that was withdrawn, and this is in its original form, as amended out of the committee, because I believe we did do an amendment in the committee before it passed out. So it's in gross version.
Okay.
Representative Liebling.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, yes, I'd like to... my memory of this isn't really, really clear, and I guess I'd like Representative Broad to kind of just remind us of what the amendments were that she thought were necessary to ease concerns, and I guess I'd like a little discussion of what might be the intended fate of this bill. I mean, if Representative Broad is going to go offer those same amendments again or has different amendments in mind at this point.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, my goal with the amendment that was offered, and again, the amendment essentially was just in Subdivision 2 of the bill, it was just going to add the words upon the diagnosis of a miscarriage, and then also on lines 1.12, it was fetal remains or both, and so the intent was to just clarify language to allay some concerns related to whether we were changing any definitions of fetus. We are not. I have no commitment to those amendments. If the language is preferable to folks the way it is right now, I'm perfectly fine with that. I would have no need to do that. Again, my only point in offering that amendment, and I did check it with a few members on your side of the aisle before I did offer it, and I apologize for the confusion that ensued after that, but my only goal was to allay concerns because I really want to see this bill pass. I think this is one of those things that we can find common ground on, and it's really, in my view, about helping women. And so I don't want it to be controversial, and that was my goal on the floor. And so, I wouldn't offer any amendments that don't need to be there to help allay concerns. I would have no problem passing the bill as it stands today.
Representative Ruth.
I actually had another committee at the time that this bill was up last year, but Representative Broad, I don't know if you've had the opportunity to speak to some of the other hospitals. I have, and many of them actually give out, there's already a form already, and actually the one I'm looking at actually has a spot that says the family would like information about the miscarriage and infant loss support group. So I guess I would speak against this bill. I don't see any need for it. It sounds like it's a hospital policy already in place. And if there are individuals who are, if there are a lot of complaints that women, for example, are not getting this information, I would suggest that maybe that's something that the hospital can, they can work through the hospital. A hospital policy address that issue.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Rood, that's great. That's exactly what I'm looking for, is for women to have information up front. There's nothing worse than finding out after the fact that you could have buried the remains of your child. There's nothing worse. And so I applaud the hospital that you spoke to. But the problem is that there's not consistency throughout the state. Not all hospitals have those policies in place. And furthermore, not all miscarriages actually occur at a hospital. So what I'm trying to do is get to exactly where that hospital is. And I think hospitals do a great job, but I want consistency for women throughout the state in terms of having this information beforehand. And I'm not changing any laws related to burial. We already have wonderful laws in Minnesota that many states don't have. All I'm looking for is consistency in information for women, very similar to the hospital that you spoke about. I've gotten no opposition from the hospital associations to the bill. In fact, they're neutral. And I guess that's all I can say. I am looking for consistency.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to say one other thing, because I do work in this area, and it's not unusual for a woman when we tell her that her pregnancy is not viable and she will be experiencing a miscarriage. It is something that sometimes can take weeks. Mm-hmm. And so just to be aware of the fact that it's not something that necessarily happens in a small amount of time or is actually the tissue that's passed is even recognizable. So,
Mr. Chairman and Representative Ruth, that's part of why I offered the original amendment that I did on the floor that was withdrawn, is just exactly understanding that process often takes time. So that's why the gynecologists that were working with me suggested the words upon diagnosis of miscarriage, so they'd have the information up front. And again, that's what we're looking for, is giving people information before the situation so that they can make informed decisions and not find things out after the fact. But that's exactly what the amendment was intended to do. It sounds like you and I have similar goals, and that what this bill is trying to do is exactly the suggestions that you're seeing already occurring. And I just think that all women should have the same opportunities as the ones that going to the hospital that you suggest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to remember the discussion of this bill from last year. What currently happens for Representative Broad? Can you tell us what currently happens at hospitals where they don't have a policy about this, or they don't notify the mother of her right to arrange burial?
Look, Mr. Chairman and Representative Kemper, I couldn't tell you exactly what happens in all cases. But certainly there are laws that govern the burial and the disposal of the remains currently. So in regards to what information is told to the women, I suppose it would depend on what location, what situation. It would be situational. And what we're trying to do is end a situational situation and create some consistency throughout the state.
Well, before we... I'm going to just move a short amendment to change 2007 to 2008.
Thank you.
Just for whatever that's worth. So all in favor of
that? Can I ask... Oh, you're going to do an amendment?
Yeah, just to change effective date to 2008.
I'll wait.
Okay. So on that, all in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? That motion prevails.
I don't know if we're going to have more discussion, but I was going to ask for a roll call.
Okay. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
I guess I'd just say this, is that I'd like to just get this bill moving forward. It actually passed out of this committee with, I think, just one dissent, and there's fair concerns, obviously, out there. I've been trying to work with a variety of different sides. I've met with Planned Parenthood a couple times. I also am meeting with NARAL again on Wednesday of next week. We're trying to get this in a position where everybody is in agreement so that we can just move the bill forward and get some consistency in helping women. Women in five other states have this notification opportunity. In all the states that it's passed, in fact, it just passed the Ohio Senate, I think there was only one dissenting vote. It's passing with flying colors in many other states because I think that there's a strong commitment to giving people information up front. And that's all this is trying to do. I've been very tight on the definitions to make sure that there's not slippery slopes out there. It's really, really about consistency and providing information up front. So I would appreciate the opportunity to have the bill heard on the floor and would encourage the committee to support moving it back to the floor like we did last year. And thank you, Mr. Chairman. I truly appreciate the opportunity to have this bill move forward.
Mr. Reverend.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to respond because the one dissenting vote was mine, as I recall, last year. And this was one of those bills where I just want to remind the committee that you know, there was a woman here to testify with Representative Broad who talked about her own miscarriage at home, you know, in terrible, gory detail, if I remember right. Certainly it was a very moving story and a very, you know, kind of shocking event. And one can't help but listen to that kind of story without feeling tremendous sympathy for the person who's relating it. And I think that the reaction of the committee, the reaction of all of us was, you know, you of course naturally want to help someone who's in that situation. But the bottom line, as I recall, is that the bill would not have helped that woman. The bill didn't relate to her. She had her miscarriage at home. And as terrible as an experience as that was, if this bill had been law at the time, it wouldn't have made one whit of difference to her situation. So, I want to remind the committee of that, not because we want to at all diminish the terrible emotional state that a woman can be in and the shocking nature of the event that it can be and, you know, how terribly sad women often feel when they lose a pregnancy. I mean, we all recognize that. But, whether this bill addresses any of that, I really doubt very much. Certainly in that situation it wouldn't. And I really don't think that we've seen any kind of necessity for this bill or any evidence that it would really have any impact. So I'm going to vote no.
Reverend Leva, could you...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I thought the nature passed bill with this anniversary bill.
We don't want to extend this too long.
I know, I just want to offer a thought, but I didn't realize this would be a blink-out thing. I hope that members could give a courtesy to Representative Brown to move this to the floor, and I was going to suggest maybe Representative Enrique would suggest request for a roll call and not make this any kind of a vote that is one of those kind of votes. I don't think it's that kind of a bill. I think it's just a nice bill that does good for a narrow group of people, and so I'm not sure how I'm going to react to that request, but I hope members could support the vote whichever way it goes.
I'll withdraw.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, that was part of the reason for the amendment as well, is upon diagnosis of a miscarriage, would bring in a broader swath of women to ensure that all women have the opportunity to bury the remains. And so, again, I'm not married to that language. I put the language in so that we could cover as many women as possible. If we want to pass the bill as it sits today, that is absolutely fine with me. I could bring in email after email or person after person to tell their story and how this bill would make a difference. There was one person who was brought in. People get nervous coming in and talking to the committee. They go off in different directions. She felt strongly about her story. But, you know, I can certainly provide clear information to the folks in this room and in this body to indicate that people really do want information up front, and that's all this does.
Okay, Reverend Shumper, and then I think we'll do both.
Just a question, I guess, or a comment, too. I feel uneasy about supporting this just because, you know, I guess we had this limited testimony on it, and frankly, I don't remember, did we have someone from the hospitals or other groups coming in testifying about how they felt about it? I don't recall that, but it just seems like we've had such a limited perspective discussing this. I feel real uneasy about voting for it.
Well, I'd say, Reverend Shumper, we actually had a full hearing on it last year. I mean, we had a hearing on it. People may have different opinions on whether it was a full hearing or not, and I don't want to really get into that. But, you know, we have moved bills like this for other members that have bounced back to the committee this year and put them back to the floor. So the intent here was not to have a full production on this bill because it had been heard before. I think the issues around this bill have been raised. And so we'll move to the vote. The motion is to move House File 599 back to the General Register. Back to the General Register. So, all in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Division.
Okay, I'm going to call for division. All those voting in favor of it, say aye. Or raise your hands, I guess. All those opposed, raise your hands. Nine to five, the ayes do have it. So, a nice one to end on. but in any event, I did want to thank Emily and Erica for all of their work this year. We actually are going to have a few more hearings, some informational hearings, once deadlines pass here. But this will be the last hearing. We're not going to have a hearing before the second deadline. We're not going to have any hearings next week, members, so everybody understands that. It'll be Representative Huntley's show at that point. So we are adjourned. Thanks, everybody.